This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Quran, the Arabian Nights, tribal folktales, the sonnets of Shelley, and the expedition journals of the great early explorers all tell the tale of a lost city called Ubar. It's described as first among the treasures of Arabia, an Atlantis of the sands. As legend has it, it was an imposing city of great riches and immoral excesses, and like Sodom and Gomorrah, was destroyed by a wrathful god, swallowed up by the desert sands without a trace. Many explorers searched for it in vain. Even Lawrence of Arabia, at the end of his life, considered taking up the challenge. Over a decade ago, documentary filmmaker Nicholas Clapp first started reading about Ubar and became obsessed with the myth. He managed to put together two expedition teams to the deserts of Oman, where, in 1992, using modern surveillance technology, they found the ruins of a city many archaeologists now believe to be Ubar. Nicholas Clapp tells the story behind the discovery in his new book, The Road to Ubar, Finding the Atlantis of the Sands. One obstacle he and his team overcame was gaining access to the Omani desert.
We were the first archaeological team allowed in the recent past, in that the area we went to had a revolution take place there back in the 50s, and was still a little bit wild and woolly. There was a little bit of the Ubar Road, by the way, was being used to some extent for drug trafficking. And so we had to be very, very careful where we went and how we went and who we went with. But the Omani government was terrific. We had Omani police guards with us, and everything went actually very smoothly.
On your first expedition into the desert, you headed out in this old helicopter. You didn't have quite enough fuel, and the pilot dropped you all off in the middle of the desert to lighten the plane and go refuel and then return to pick you up. That just sounds terrifying to me. Was it?
Well, everybody kind of pretended it wasn't, but it kind of was, in that we didn't have enough fuel to get back from out in the dunes. And it was very, very hot day. It was well over maybe 122, 124, which meant the helicopter burned a lot more fuel than he thought he'd need. And so the only way to get out of there was to drop everybody off and take quite a bit of the cargo off it as well, and then for the pilot alone to go back and get some fuel and come back and retrieve us. And in the haste to do all this, realizing that every second counted, when we got out of the helicopter, we got out, but most of the water stayed on the helicopter. So we had relatively little water. But he assured us he'd be back in an hour. And about a couple hours later, we were getting a little nervous and a little thirsty. And what had happened is his fuel depot had been raided by God knows who, and so he had to limp even on a little further and fuel up and come back. But that was a very nice sight to see, that just the little helicopter coming from way off across the dunes in our direction.
What does a hot day in the desert feel like?
It's a unique experience. It's a little like, the thing that comes to mind is like a sauna, but it's much more intense. It's like kind of walking into a furnace. And, you know, particularly if you, say, get out of an air-conditioned vehicle or you get out of a helicopter, it really hits you like a blast. But you get adapted to it. And there's a kind of a saying that I actually got from some ranger friends in the California desert, and they said that the human body is designed to work up to, quite effectively, up to about 130 degrees as long as you had enough water. So we always had bottles of water with us, and we almost had to drink as frequently as every 2 to 3 minutes. But if you did that, you were okay.
What did you find on your first expedition?
We found the road, and which was a great relief, and we also found very good evidence that the road was really, really old, in that we found where it had come out from underneath a sand dune that was about 600 feet high, and a sand dune like that would take hundreds of years to form. So we knew that the road preceded the sand dune and thus was very old. And we tracked quite a bit of the road by helicopter. And beyond that, we didn't find too much. In fact, we're kind of discouraged and in fact thought that our sponsors would dump us when we came back pretty empty-handed. But they didn't. And they said, well, why don't you come back and try again, which we did.
What does an ancient road look like in the sands?
In the sands. It's a series of parallel camel tracks. And I think there were pretty close to 100 of them running side by side where in the old days, evidently, there's some classical reports of caravans having as many as 2,000 camels. And they would go in as big a cluster as they could so that the outriders could protect them from attacks and marauding. And so you have these parallel tracks and to the width of about 100 yards, which is about a 10-lane freeway, which was pretty neat because that really did show up from space. Although, curiously, though you could see the road very clearly from hundreds of miles up, you could actually get down on the ground and not see it at all. It was invisible in some places. In fact, most places. And that's because the satellites were not so much measuring a physical road, but measuring where the Earth had been compressed and kind of hammered down by the passage of thousands and thousands of camels and caravans.
Driving on sand dunes seems to take a special skill, and it wasn't one that you possessed.
Absolutely
<you're>
not.
Right. what are the problems of driving on the sands?
Well, the right way to do it is the way the Bedouin do it. And it's almost like a Zen approach to driving, is that they just glide across. I don't know how they do it. They just glide across the dunes, and they can hop into a vehicle that's not theirs, they've never driven before, and go through the worst sand, and just and it's absolutely effortless. And what they're doing is that they can what they call read the sands. They can see just by the way the light refracts, the coloration, the slip face in the dune, they can know just how soft it is and exactly the speed they need to go through it and the angle to take and so forth. And, you know, any of us would try following one of these guys and we'd immediately be dug into the hubcaps, I mean, in a matter of seconds. So our only solution, which worked out okay, was a very foot to the floor, very, very fast driving, almost reckless. So at least we had a lot of momentum going in case we started to get stuck. And of course, we got stuck a lot. But there was a little technique. There's something that they used over there that we don't have here called sand ladders. And these are aluminum ladders. And you get stuck and you jack the vehicle up and put the ladders under the tires and then get enough speed on these 8 or 10 foot aluminum ladders to just drive out and be on your way.
You write that you ran into things called camel wallows.
Yeah, those would be back where they're on the gravel plains, where there were often some kind of tracks, old military roads or left over from oil exploration that you could follow for part of the way. Is that the camels would pick a particular place to their liking and use it to take sand baths. And they'd wallow around it and basically create this patch, which would be maybe, 20 feet long, 30 feet long, and 3 or 4 feet deep, and just like quicksand. And you'd be driving along, fairly fast, maybe 50, 60 miles an hour, ripping along these gravel roads or tracks, and you'd hit one of these things, and the vehicle would spin and slide all over the place. And it was, until we learned about them and how to handle them, it was a little startling. And there were quite a routinely in that part of the world, quite a number of vehicles flip over when they hit camel wallows. And what we did was we kind of mapped where they all were so that we knew it at 32.1 1 kilometer to expect one. So we could either go around it or speed up and go through it really fast with kind of a death grip on the wheel.
I'm talking with Nicholas Clapp. He's a documentary filmmaker. About a decade ago, he became fascinated with the legend of Ubar, an ancient lost city in the Arabian desert known as the Atlantis of the Sands. Using modern radar technology and a lot of old-fashioned exploring, he believes he found Ubar in the deserts of Oman. He's written about his quest in his new book, The Road to Ubar. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is documentary filmmaker Nicholas Clapp. He spent over a decade searching out the fabled city of Ubar in the desert of Oman. His new book is The Road to Ubar. While you were investigating in the desert, you were visited by tribesmen who you say drifted down from the mountains, and you write that their hair had the fragrance of frankincense.
Mm-hmm.
Did it really? I mean...
Yeah. They were pretty startling people. The kind of the geography of the areas, you have the coast and there's mountains, and you get out to the desert and eventually the dunes. And in the mountains, there is a tribe called the Shahra who believe, and quite rightly so, we too came to believe, that they were actually descendants of the people of Ubar. And their dress was extraordinary. They wear these kind of purple robes that were slung over one shoulder like in classical times. And their hair was braided and wound around their heads. And their hair was often dyed blue. The men used makeup with, you know, eyeliner and so forth. They're very striking people. And their and turned out their language was fascinating because they didn't speak Arabic. They spoke a language that came before Arabic, came before Hebrew, a very, very early Middle Eastern language, which was very strange sounding. They one name that's been given is the language of birds, and it sounded like there were a lot of chirps and squeaks and so forth that were very bird-like when they talked.
One of these men became your guide, and he had studied in in England?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
And he had become kind of an amateur historian of the tribe. And he took you to a very famous place called the Vale of Remembrance, which mm-hmm. is a valley where this tribe had and many Arabic tribes had laid their dead to rest. What does it look like there? Can you see skeletons, bodies
yeah.
in the sands, or you just see graves?
It's a very spooky. It's a long canyon that goes from the mountains down into the open desert, and it's filled with graves of all periods, right up to the present. And you can tell, like, recent burials. Well, recent being the last 1,300 years, because there's the graves are laid out so the deceased would face Mecca. But when you don't have that alignment, you know you're dealing with earlier graves, and there were even kind of walled off sections, and you could find a little niche open place in the wall and peek in and see just rows of skulls looking back out at you. It was very, very eerie.
So, finally, where did you find Ubar?
It was actually right where it ought to have been. And if we'd been a little smarter, we would have found it right away. It was out on the end of a long gravel plain where the camel caravans would have come, and just before the caravans went into the dunes. And something that we found out was that camels are a little like cars, and that you need a different tread for different terrains. So, for instance, if you're going to take a four-wheel drive across a flinty gravel plain, you need very hard, narrow tires. But as soon as you get in the sand, you need, or you best have, big balloon tires. It was the same thing with camels, and that they had in ancient days, and still today, camels that go out across the plain have small, very tough feet. And then the camels that go on into the dunes have great big floppy feet, many times the size. And so Ubar was the changeover point. And it was, they selected it for mainly because of a terrific water supply there. And if we put that all together, figure out where did the camels change, where did they change from one set of camels to another, that would have taken us to Ubar a lot sooner. But we found it nonetheless.
You began an excavation in a fort that had a kind of ruined fort that people said, oh, this could never be Ubar. It's too young. It's not old mm-hmm. enough. It had been discounted many times by other explorers. But you believed that there was an older fort under it.
Yeah.
And you started an excavation. Why don't you, tell us, what point did you think, oh, I found it. we got it.
Yeah. It was... We dug there. At first, there was really nothing to say that this wasn't a fairly recent ruin, fairly recent being maybe 500 years old. But we were kind of desperate, and this was our last place, so we figured, the only other alternate was kind of sneaking out of the country. So we started to dig, and two things kind of happened. One was we found very identifiable ancient pottery, Greek, Roman, Syrian, Persian. And that put the threshold way back. We knew right away that we were dealing with quite an ancient site. And at the same time, we found that the little fort that was the first thing we saw was actually part of a corner of a very large citadel with towers and walls that was Ubar and was buried very close to the surface.
Did the ruins you found paint an unambiguous picture of how this city came to be a lost city and how it was destroyed?
Yeah, that was really the kind of the clincher. I mean, it was in the right place. It was the right age. It fitted in with the frankincense trade. And in the legend of Ubar, we could never quite figure it out until we came to the place. In the legend of Ubar, it was destroyed by sinking into the sands. And, many ancient cities are burned or pillaged or wrecked by earthquakes. But what did it mean that it sank into the sands? And it turned out that was actually what happened, in that the city had been built over a water source. And the water source was in an underground cavern. And the more the city prospered, which it did, the more the water was pulled out of the cavern until one day, probably sometime after 300 AD, it collapsed overnight and fell into what became a sinkhole, quite a spectacular sinkhole. And that was the end of Ubar. And it was the same in myth as in reality.
Now, are you just famous as this amateur who stumbled upon an ancient city among archaeologists, or did they dispute your findings?
No, I was pretty wary about, being an amateur. But one thing we did was we didn't kind of romp off on our own. We involved professional archaeologists every step of the way, and the relationship with professionals has been wonderful then and since. And they've good dozen archaeologists have pitched in, kind of helping us figure out the little ramifications, nooks and corners of the legend, and exactly who these people were and how they related to the ancient world. So, one thing that was nice about being an amateur is you could really afford to fall on your face and really take almost absurd chances because you didn't have a career at stake. So that was to the amateur's advantage. But the relationship between amateur and professional worked out terrifically.
Thanks a lot for talking today, Nicholas Clapp.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Nicholas Clapp's new book is The Road to Ubar.